Hi, I'm Eve Frank Blues. I'm your licensed nutrition counselor. Here on No Nonsense Nutrition, every week there's something in the news about health. The good, the bad, the ugly. But there was an announcement that came up this week that really did rock my world. And it rocked my world because one of the things that I have tried to do in practice over the years is inform people about the fundamental problem with pharmaceutical drugs, with medicines in general, that have to do with stopping a response. You know, your nose starts to run, so you take an antihistamine and you stop the nose from running because you got to go to work. When we look at the cholesterol-lowering drugs, when we look at the antihistamines, when we look at the stomach acid drugs, when we look at so many of these things, even right down to the simple aspirin, a lot of times all we're doing is treating a symptom. We're treating the symptom, we're not treating the cause. If you get a headache and you take an acetaminophen, you take an ibuprofen, you take an naproxen or an aspirin, and you get rid of the headache, well, all well and good, but what was the trigger? What was the thing that initiated that? So granted, if you're allergic to cats or allergic to oak trees or allergic to strawberries and you get exposed to any of those things, you're going to have a response and you're going to need an antihistamine in order to try to control that response. But moreover, you're going to need to simply avoid those things as best you can. Well, you can't take a chainsaw to Sarasota County and cut all the oak trees down. So using a natural antihistamine, using Mother Nature's antihistamine, is going to be a better choice than using a drug. But you got to realize that when you stop a response, the body's never wrong. The body's never wrong. When somebody's got diarrhea, it's because the body's saying, get this out of here. And then you take Imodium and stop the diarrhea, then whatever the problem was that caused the diarrhea in the first place is still in there. And so as soon as that drug wears off, shazam, you're back to diarrhea again. Well, the news that came out this week that I found really shocking was that people use proton pump inhibitors. These are anti-stomach acid drugs, are 21% more likely to experience a heart attack than those who do not use the antacids. Now listen to that loud and clear. 21% more likely to have a heart attack. That elevated risk of heart attack in the general population is an astounding number. And these findings come from a study of 16 million different documents representing 2.9 million people. The group that collected this data collected over a million patients from web-based electronic medical records and 1.8 million from Stanford Hospital. And the data was scanned for patients who had been prescribed proton pump inhibitors and other antacids such as H2 blockers, and we're going to talk about the difference between them, to see whether any major cardiovascular events were mentioned in their records. There was a 16 to 21% increased risk of myocardial infarction, the $5 word for heart attack. And now these drugs are available over the counter. If they had had these algorithms in place, they would have found this as much as 15 years ago. So estimates from the Food and Drug Administration say 1 in 14 Americans have been prescribed proton pump inhibitors. In fact, they were the third most used drug in the United States. Now I think they're up to second after Lipitor as a prescription. So what are we going to do if we have heartburn? What are we going to do if we have acid indigestion? Oh, I can remember as a kid, the first acid indigestion ads on TV, and it showed a faucet inside a stomach that was going drip, 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 and you chewed up a Rolaids, and the Rolaids broke into little pieces, and it sucked up 47 times its weight in excess stomach acid. Well, I want you to find me somebody who's got excess stomach acid. That is so incredibly rare, the proverbial hen's tooth is common as compared to it. But if you watch American television, you'd think every other person has, quote, excess stomach acid. What's really true is most of the time we don't have enough. And studies have been made over and over again that show that as we age, stomach acid goes down. In fact, one of the studies showed that 40% of individuals over 80 years old didn't make any stomach acid at all. But when we look at this frequency of use of these PPIs and H2 blockers and antacids, we have reason to be concerned. It isn't just that we're spending $15 billion on acid-stopping medications. It isn't just that, you know, these drugs like Nexium. Nexium was second highest selling drug behind Lipitor. That's a pretty sobering statistic. I can remember watching a comic on TV one time, and he was saying that he was watching the Super Bowl, and one ad after another came on: acid indigestion, gas, constipation, bloating, diarrhea, just one after the other of digestive remedies. And the comic screamed into the microphone, "It's the food!" Well, you're right, it is the food. Or the lack of food. I mean, they're putting delicious edibles in our mouth. You know, the FDA just banned trans fats. Trans fats in foods. What are trans fats? What does trans mean? It means that a molecule is hooked on, kind of cantilevered, a little bit sideways. And so when we take an oil, a vegetable oil, and we put it in a 50,000-gallon tank, and we run high-pressure hydrogen through it, and the hydrogen attaches to the end of the bond, but it attaches kind of sideways. It's sort of goofy. You ever made a key, and they didn't get all the burrs off the edge of the teeth on the key, and you stuck it in the lock? It would go in the lock, but it wouldn't turn. Well, that's what happens when you make a trans fat. You alter the shape of a molecule. Remember the foundation of chemistry. You alter the shape of a molecule, you alter the function of a molecule. So when we begin to look at these trans fats, at these ways to take these inexpensive vegetable oils and make them last forever, make more texture to baked goods, because that's where a lot of them are, is snackies and baked goods. These trans fats, latest studies say 37% of every food that's in a grocery store has got trans fats in it. And so now the FDA is saying, hey, there's no doubt. There's no doubt this is contributing to heart disease. There's no doubt that this is potentially contributing to cancers. There's no doubt that it's contributing to obesity, because that fat goes into the cell wall, and then the cell wall doesn't operate normally. That fat goes into the brain, and then the brain doesn't operate normally. I know there's a joke about the Congress here somewhere, but I don't know what it is. When we begin to look at eating foods that aren't foods, and just eating too much, just flat out eating too much. I had European clients in my practice last week, and they are astounded at the size of the portions that are served in restaurants. It's not uncommon for my husband and I to order two salads and one entree and split them and have plenty of food. Just the sheer volume of food that we eat puts a stress on the stomach. The sad truth is that we are trying to find a pill for every ill. Rather than looking at what we ate and realizing that eating a pepperoni pizza and a chocolate malt probably isn't a really good thing for our stomach or for our body, we're going to pop something. Well, when we pop that antacid and we get rid of that indigestion, we've really just created another problem. So let's talk for a minute about digestion. And I know we've done that before on No Nonsense Nutrition, but let's just review, because a lot of people don't understand what all these body parts do. You know, when I put something in my mouth secretes an enzyme called ptyalin that helps to break down starch. That enzyme in your mouth will help you digest a piece of toast, or an ear of corn, or some potato, or a cookie. But actually, it doesn't do a darn thing for the steak, or the salmon, or the egg. doesn't work on protein, doesn't do anything for the fats that are there, whether the butter was on the baked potato or whether the fat was on the side of the steak. The only thing that enzyme in your mouth works on is starch. So mama said chew your food, mama should have said chew your starches. And you can demonstrate that by giving your dog a piece of meat. Your dog doesn't chew up a piece of meat. Your dog goes gulp, gulp, and the meat is gone. All of the digestion of the protein is taking place in the stomach and the small intestine. It's not taking place in the mouth. So, yeah, you need to chew it. You don't really want to go gulp, gulp like your puppy does because of the risk of choking. I mean, more people choke on steak than any other thing. But it doesn't really break down. Now when that food travels that 9 inches through the esophagus and it gets into the stomach, it's gone through a transfer tube. That's all the esophagus does. The esophagus doesn't have any action on the food. All it is a pipe to get stuff from your mouth to your stomach. And that esophagus has very delicate tissue in it. And then when it gets to your stomach, it goes through a little junction where your stomach and your esophagus are hooked together. And where that little junction is where hiatal hernias can occur. And hiatal hernias just mean that some of the stomach material is pooched up through the opening of the diaphragm. And so the nature of the structure of a hiatal hernia is it's probably caused more than any other single thing by constipation. Because when people have constipation, they grunt, they strain, and when they do so, they put back pressure on those upper digestive organs and can literally force part of the stomach up through that opening where it doesn't belong. That can be corrected by a chiropractor. Chiropractors do a marvelous adjustment that allows that stomach to go back into its natural place. But right there, it's not really a sphincter. It doesn't really snap shut, but it's a little valve that's there at the top of the stomach that closes and keeps the stomach acid where it belongs, down in the stomach. And inside the lining of the stomach, and the stomach is lined with this incredible mucous membrane. Because one of the mysteries of nutrition and physiology is why doesn't the stomach digest itself? Well, it's got this mucous membrane on it that protects the cells of the stomach so that the acid factories that are in the stomach, the parietal cells, you have millions of them, when they manufacture the acid doesn't hurt the stomach. Now, if we violate that mucous membrane in there, if we do something to eliminate that mucous membrane, then the acid can work directly on the stomach, and that creates what we know as an ulcer, a stomach ulcer or a duodenal ulcer, the duodenum being the next section down the pipe after the stomach. So it's the mouth, the esophagus, the stomach, the duodenum. Now, in the stomach, this hydrochloric acid is really powerful. If you took some of that hydrochloric acid out of your stomach and you put it on your arm, you'd burn your skin off. That hydrochloric acid that's in there is going to take another enzyme called pepsin, and it's going to split it and make peptidase. It's going to, anything that ends in an IN is an enzyme, anything that ends in an ASE is an enzyme. So pepsin, peptidase, enzymes. Together with the hydrochloric acid, they start chopping up the protein. And chopping up, literally. I mean, we mush and mush and mush. The stomach is the second mechanical set of teeth. It literally chompa chompa chompas the food and keeps rendering it down into something that's about the viscosity of pea soup by the time that it leaves the stomach. So even if you didn't chew your food really good in your mouth, which is a mistake, their stomach is going to chew it again. You know, one of the reasons I tell people not to drink while they're eating is because people underchew. They underchew and then swallow their food with their iced tea, with their pop, with their coffee, whatever it is. So drink a glass of water before you eat the meal so that your thirst is quenched and you're hydrated, and then eat the meal without necessarily taking in any liquid at the same time. You can turn around and take liquid again at the end. You know, have your cup of decaf, your cup of hot tea at the end of the meal. So now this hydrochloric acid gets produced by the parietal cells, and then the pepsin goes in there, and they start cutting up the protein, because protein is a gigantic molecule. It's a gigantic molecule. Proteins are made of amino acids, just like the words that I'm using are made out of letters. And so imagine that that piece of meat, that piece of fish, that egg that you just ate is a big, long paragraph of words with 200 letters in that paragraph. Well, what the enzymes do is first they cut the paragraph into sentences, and then they cut the sentences into words, and then they cut the words into individual letters. And that's what happens in your digestive system. We start out by cleaving the protein into proteoses, and then we take proteoses and turn them into peptides, and we take peptides and turn them into individual amino acids. Paragraphs to words, paragraphs to sentences, sentences to words, and words to letters. That's the breakdown structure as the food continues to move through this 25-foot pipe that allows you to be alive. You know, if it wasn't for that digestive system, we couldn't operate. It is the whole reason that we're able to have this conversation, to blink our eyes, to walk across the room. It's because the digestive system allows us to humanize these non-human things that we put into our body. It allows us to take all of this foreign material that we expose our immune system to every day and adapt it in such a way that it's humanized, that we can use it, that we can turn it into cells. I can't look at the back of my hand and see the turkey and stuffing and broccoli I had for dinner last night, but it's become my cells. I can't look at the papaya and pineapple and raspberries and blueberries and things that I had this morning with my Greek yogurt and see that anywhere on my body, but it has become me. So we take these proteins apart and get them down to letters, and then we take the letters and reconstruct them back into the proteins that make the human body. So we produce this acid. And then after the stomach has finished doing what it's got to do, and most food stays in our stomach anywhere from a half an hour to 4 hours, because the stomach, all of these enzymes are very temperature sensitive, and so we're supposed to be 98.6 degrees. So let's just, for ease of conversation, say the inside of the stomach is 100 degrees. These enzymes are designed to work in that 100-degree environment. That's why if you're sipping on an ice-cold beverage while you're eating, you're lowering the stomach temperature, you're lengthening the amount of time it takes to digest food, because remember another basic rule of chemistry, things move faster with heat. So when your stomach is 100 degrees, the enzymes work the most efficiently. If you're eating a chilled salad and drinking that glass of iced tea and having an iced dessert at the end of the meal, you're going to stretch the digestion time. But let's say all of this chewing, this secondary chewing, has been done. It's created a mass that's called chyme. That spells C-H-Y-M-E, chyme, and that's what actually leaves the stomach. And you got this little pyloric valve at the bottom of the stomach, a little flap valve. And a teaspoon, a teaspoon, a teaspoon, a teaspoon at a time leaves the stomach and goes into the duodenum. And the duodenum isn't really a separate organ. It's really the upper 12 or 14 inches of the small intestine. But we identify it as a pocket that occurs right after the stomach, because this is action central. The stomach is emptying from the top. The pancreas is squirting in from the left side. The liver gallbladder is squirting in from the right side. There's so much chemistry that takes place in the duodenum. And one of the most important things that takes place in the duodenum is the pancreas makes bicarbonate of soda. You know it as baking soda. Mother always had a box of Arm & Hammer baking soda. She'd put it in the refrigerator to keep the smells down. But there was always a teaspoon to stir into some water if you got an upset stomach, because bicarbonate of soda is an alkali, and alkalis neutralize acids. Well, your pancreas actually makes bicarbonate of soda, and it squirts it into the duodenum to neutralize the acid of the stomach, because it doesn't want that high acid environment going down there into the rest of the bowel, into the rest of the digestive system. The only place in your body that's supposed to be acid is your stomach, and the inside of your stomach, and your skin. That's it. Everything else in your body is alkaline. So when we look at this next step as the chyme, as the mush of food, leaves the stomach and goes into the duodenum. The acidity of that material is what tells the pancreas to go to work. If those stomach contents are real acid, then the pancreas goes, okay, I got to go to work, and it squirts bicarbonate of soda, and then it also squirts its whole payload of enzymes. Proteases to digest protein, lipases to digest fats, and amylases to digest starches. Remember, enzymes are one-trick dogs. The enzyme that digests the protein doesn't work on an apple. The enzyme that digests your corn doesn't work on your steak. So even though there's just a little bit of lipase that's made in the stomach fundamentally is working on protein, just like the mouth is fundamentally working on starch. But by the time we get to the duodenum, we're working on everything. We got the proteases working on the proteins, the amylases working on the starch, and the lipases working on the fats. And at the same time, we've got bile squirting in from the right side because your liver manufactures bile and then it sends it to the gallbladder to be stored. And so as long as you still have a gallbladder, then the bile will get squirted in only when food is there. If your gallbladder has been thrown on the garbage heap, then your liver is going to squirt bile into your digestive system all the time, and that can be very irritating. You know, one of the things the surgeons failed to tell people is that a third of individuals who have their gallbladder removed have diarrhea for the rest of their lives. They also failed to tell them that a lot of times when the gallbladder is removed, the symptoms are exactly the same 6 weeks later because they never solved the problem in the first place. Okay, so we're back to the duodenum. We neutralize these acids, we squirt in this new payload of enzymes, and then the food moves down through the 20 feet of the small intestine, gradually being broken down into the letters, the fats being broken down into fatty acids, the starches being broken down into glucose ultimately. And then somewhere along that track, those nutrients are absorbed. Only the simplest, only the smallest and simplest nutrients can pass through the wall of the bowel and get into the bloodstream, where they're going to go to your liver, and your liver is going to rearrange them back into things that make up you. And that is from the directives of the liver, the directives of your DNA, the needs of the body. All of those things are helping to determine what happens to those foods. Your liver has to decide to keep some proteins so that it can make hormones and enzymes. It has to send some to the blood to make albumin and globulin. And then it sends some out to the tissue to repair the wound that you got when you slammed your leg into the coffee table yesterday. So the liver's a pretty smart organ. You know, it's a big thing, 3.5 to 4.5 pounds. You know, a lot of people don't realize how big that liver is. So even though food doesn't actually go through the liver or the gallbladder or the pancreas, they're still considered organs of digestion. And finally, after the number of hours that it takes to get through the small bowel, then that material is given to the large intestine, and that large intestine, about 3 to 5 feet long, depending on the size of the person, its primary role is to recycle the water, to suck the water back out of that fecal material so that we can turn it into a banana, we can turn it into a brown banana, a log, by the time that it makes it to the exit door. Actually, your bowel recycles about 2.5 gallons of water every day. Yeah, it's pretty astounding, isn't it? So when we follow that whole track from the mouth starting to break down starches, the stomach starting to break down protein, the duodenum then continuing the digestion of the protein and the starches and then beginning the digestion of the fats, this is really a freaking remarkable system. Now, we ate that pineapple pizza and drank that chocolate malt. Now we have heartburn. And so we take a Tums or a Rolaids or a Mylanta or a Pepto-Bismol or an Alka-Seltzer or something. Well, let's take Tums off the list right away because it's calcium carbonate, which is nothing but chalk. At least Rolaids has some magnesium in it. But, yeah, you can stop the feeling. And most of that feeling is between the breasts. It's right there where the esophagus and the stomach join, because when we make gases inside the stomach, the gases cause the acid to splash back up into the esophagus. And we're never supposed to have those acids on that delicate esophageal tissue. So the first thing you do if you have heartburn is drink some water, wash that acid off the esophagus. And yeah, we want to neutralize that acid right then because we don't want to damage the esophagus. You can do so with some baking soda and water. But the thing is, you go to the market, and now you go to the drugstore, and you can get everything over the counter that used to be a prescription drug. So even though you can't get your hands on Nexium yet, the only reason that they've gone from prescriptions to over-the-counter is because their patents ran out. So you've got all of these Prilosec products and Axid and Pepcid and things that are designed to stop the production of stomach acid. Well, think about that. When you try to stop the production of stomach acid, not only are you going to affect the digestion of the food, but you're forgetting, if you ever knew, that the primary function of stomach acid isn't even to digest the protein. The primary function of stomach acid is to sterilize your food. Yeah, it kills the critters on it. It kills the bugs that show up on your food, whether they're parasites or yeasts or bacterias. A lot of food that we put in our mouth is contaminated. Right, you really believe that everybody that worked in a restaurant washed their hands all the time. Okay, keep believing. It's one of the reasons that people that take proton pump inhibitors and H2 blockers have 6 times the amount of food poisoning. Because we didn't kill the critters on our food, and then those bacteria went on to inoculate the small intestine. You know, there's not a month that goes by that I don't have somebody walk in my clinic and say, I had that 24-hour stomach flu. Well, there is no such thing as a 24-hour stomach flu. You had food poisoning. And people think because, you know, my husband and I and my kids all sat at the table and we all ate the same chicken, that one person can't end up getting sick and the other ones don't. Yeah, but it's possible. You know, one of the arguments of science is how many actual bacteria does it take to make an infection in an individual? So when we begin to look at the fact that we're now going to put our thumb on these parietal cells, we're going to tell it to not make stomach acid. Well, you can't fool Mother Nature. If you tell those cells not to make stomach acid, guess what? They make more cells that make stomach acid. We actually increase the number of factories. Well, the first bad news that came out was the news that said that if somebody stayed on these drugs, which according to the PDR, the physician's desk reference, you're supposed to use for 2 weeks to 2 months. So somebody gets an endoscopy, the scoping of the stomach, and they find out they actually, golly, really have an ulcer. You know, there's an ulcer in there the size of the pad of your thumb. And so they take these drugs for 2 weeks to allow that ulcer to heal up, and then you're done. But a whole lot of people go on these drugs, and they stay on these drugs for years. There's not a month that goes by that I don't have somebody come in my practice that's been on these drugs for years, long after any ulcer is healed. So then the body actually makes more acid factories. And then when they try to get off the drug, they actually have worse heartburn than they had before, because they may have more acid factories. But generally speaking, what's actually happening is people don't have enough acid. The reason they got the splashback, the reason they got the heartburn, especially 4 hours after they eat, is because the contents of the stomach weren't acid enough to turn on the pancreas to make the bicarbonate of soda. We didn't neutralize the acid. That's how we end up with a duodenal ulcer. And so a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to drink some apple cider vinegar and that's going to solve the problem. Actually, if you put some apple cider vinegar in at the very beginning of a meal and it acidifies your stomach more, then the pepsin, the other enzyme that's in there, can actually work better. But it doesn't cure the problem. So the first bad news that we saw was the fact that people that stayed on these drugs for 2 years ended up with a B12 deficiency. Vitamin B12 needs something called intrinsic factor in order to be absorbed, and that's manufactured in the stomach. One of the big concerns that I have about vegans and vegetarians are the low B12 numbers. And if you get blood values of B12, they're virtually useless. If your B12 isn't nailed to the ceiling, if it isn't already at the very, very top end of normal, 1,000 or more, then you're not going to have much B12 in your cells. And that's not only going to contribute to neurological things and memory issues, but it's going to contribute to everything from pernicious anemia to fatigue. If we don't have enough acid in the stomach, we don't have enough intrinsic factor in the stomach, and when we suppress these acids, we end up B12 deficient by the end of 2 years. Well, then we got more bad news. We found out that when people stayed on these drugs, they had higher fracture rates. Now, granted, the higher fracture rates were mostly in older individuals, but these are also the people that are taking these drugs. You don't see teenagers popping these drugs. And so the nature of these fracture rates, we used to think that the reason that they had fractures when they were on acid suppressors was they weren't breaking out their calcium out of their food and absorbing it. And that is partially true. But now we've discovered just within the last year that those proton pump inhibitors actually work directly on the osteoblast, the bone builder cells inside of our bone, and suppress the bone building process. So people that have been on these drugs for 5 years or longer have increased fracture rates. So we got B12 deficiencies, increased fracture rates, and 21% increase in heart attacks. Oh, great. Now all you have to do when you have your pepperoni pizza and your chocolate malt is pop one of those pills and get rid of that old pesky heartburn and possibly put yourself in trouble for many even more serious conditions. You know, when drug companies are making more than $7 billion a year selling acid-suppressing medications, the last thing they want is for doctors and their patients to learn how to treat heartburn and GERD without these drugs. And since two-thirds of all medical research is being done by drug companies, it's virtually guaranteed we won't see any large studies on the effect of certain diets or certain natural treatments on heartburn overall. Want to bet? I think that's what's going to happen. So since we know that acid secretion declines with age, and it's well established that GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, a made-up term by the pharmaceutical industry, increases with age, again, if heartburn was caused by too much stomach acid, we'd have teenagers popping Rolaids. But that's exactly what we don't see. If we carefully test people over age 40 who are having heartburn, indigestion, and gas, 90% of the time you're going to find inadequate acid production by the stomach. What can we do? Well, the first thing we can do is realize we don't want anybody to have heartburn. We don't want anybody to have that acid splash back and get into their esophagus and cause burning and therefore scarring. Because getting your esophagus stretched every 6 months for the rest of your life is really no day at the beach. But if you want to cure a disease, that means you have to eliminate its cause. When a disease is cured, the symptoms don't return once the treatment is removed. This is not the case for drugs for heartburn and GERD. As soon as the patient stops taking them, the symptoms return, and they're often worse than they were before they started the drug. But you have to remember, pharmaceutical companies are not really interested in cures. They're not profitable. It's much more lucrative to sell drugs to people that they have to take for the rest of their life than it is to promote dietary changes that would cure the problem. But as long as we're gulping down food in the car, as I was driving here to the station this morning, there was somebody that had one of those breakfast sandwiches that they were eating at the light at Fruitville and Tuttle, and taking their, you know, gigantic vat of coffee and slugging it down, you know, while they were on their way to work. I can't imagine that they're going to do a much better job with their lunch. When we're gulping food, and when we've made food a pain, we've made getting food into us a bother, we no longer see that the time that we spend in the kitchen, that the time that we spend preparing is not only loving to our families, it's loving to ourselves. It's really self-care. You know, so much of the food that's bought in grocery stores today is prepared food. You know, we're buying the meal in a box out of the freezer. We're buying the deli food to take home. And I do the same thing. You know, I stop at a couple of different markets and I buy takeout salads and takeout other things to reduce the overall demand on me, especially when I have evening meetings like I do tonight. But there's a lot of people, that's all they eat. I had a client came to me one time. She goes to the grocery store on the first of the month. She buys 30 Lean Cuisine dinners, and that's what she eats every night. And that was when I said, could you buy a head of broccoli? And let's take those trees of broccoli and cook them in the microwave, because remember, microwave broccoli has more nutrients in it than even steamed broccoli, despite the fact that that doesn't make me happy. It's what's really true scientifically. Let's add that tree of broccoli to your Lean Cuisine dinner. At least that's a step up. That was how we began getting her to go into the kitchen and actually fix her own food. So when we look at poor quality food, rushed eating, the stress that people are going through when they're rushing eating. I spoke to a client last week, and that client said, I have 10 minutes. I have 10 minutes to eat lunch between clients. Yikes. Trouble. So if we're going to have a magnitude of improvement, one of the very first things that we have to do is look at the combination of food that we're eating. You know, food combiners, the original work that Shelton did back a century ago, told us that when we ate certain foods together, sometimes they fight with each other. And one of the rules that I have in my own personal life is fruit, eat it alone or leave it alone. When you mix fruit with other food, you have a tendency to get gassy. And it's real simple to understand. Fruit doesn't have a lot to break down. It's a really simple food. So when you put fruit in an empty stomach, the only thing it's going to do is hang out there long enough to get to 98.6 degrees, and then it's going to leave the stomach and go into the small intestine. There's no protein in fruit, or less than 5%, so there's nothing in there to hang out to break down. So if I eat that piece of fruit and then I wait 20 minutes or so and then have my eggs for breakfast, if I eat that piece of fruit and then wait a period of time and then have my bowl of cereal for breakfast, the fruit will have digested out of the stomach, moved into the small intestine, moved through the duodenum, and my stomach is empty. I can put the next food in. But if I turn around and eat that fruit after I had my eggs, when my eggs are going to hang out in my stomach for 3 or 4 hours, then the fruit can't turn to the eggs and say, excuse me, could you move over so I can get by? So it gets trapped in that 98.6 degree oven, and it starts to ferment. And what's the first byproduct of fermentation? Gas. And so not only do we get bloaty and gassy, we'll get burpy, but we'll also make the gas that will splash the acid back up on the esophagus. So fruit, eat it alone or leave it alone, is one of the rules that I definitely adhere to. But the nature of grab-and-go food is a real issue when people are grazing all day long. There's lots of conditions that recommend eating 6 small meals a day. I'm really not in agreement with that, never have been. I think we need to eat a full and complete meal, wait 4 or 5 hours and eat a full and complete meal. Because if you eat a full and complete meal, you don't need to be snacking 90 minutes from now or 2 hours from now. And if you've got hypoglycemia and you're having problems regulating your blood sugar, then you need to do a better job with making your meal more balanced. Because if you have an adequate amount of protein and fats and slow digesting starches, your blood sugar should stay stable for hours. If not, we're going to look at things like chromium and vanadium, the trace minerals that are necessary to keep blood sugar stable. Now, let's just put a parenthesis in here and remember that there is a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori, or H. pylori, that can cause all kinds of problems in the stomach. And if heartburn came on suddenly and severely, then it is important that your physician test you for H. pylori, both quantify and qualify. When we quantify and qualify says yes or no, I have an antibody to H. pylori or I don't have an antibody to H. pylori. But quantify gives us an actual count of how many antibodies we're making to this bacteria, and it helps us to know whether our treatment protocol is working. Conventionally, H. pylori is treated with antibiotics. Holistically, H. pylori can be treated with an extract of broccoli called sulforaphane. But the nature of H. pylori is it does play a significant role in the pathogenesis of GERD and other digestive disorders. It is probably the most common chronic bacterial pathogen that exists in humans. And it suppresses stomach acid secretion. When you eradicate H. pylori, it improves virtually all patients who have low stomach acid. So one of the first things that we can do is start using digestive enzymes. Just using pancreatic enzymes, enzymes that are often taken before a meal to assist in the digestion of the food, that is a plus. But there are also enzymes that can be taken after a meal, and they are betaine hydrochloride. Betaine hydrochloride is a step away from hydrochloric acid. You couldn't actually take hydrochloric acid. You'd burn your tongue off. But when you take betaine hydrochloride, it's a step before hydrochloric acid. It will turn into hydrochloric acid in the stomach. It's often used with an herb called gentian. Green gentian is what you know as bitters. If you've ever looked behind the bar and seen the bitters that get put into an old-fashioned, Angostura bitters are the most common one. That's an herb called green gentian. Gentiani grows right out on Siesta Key, as a matter of fact, or at least one species of it does. Taking a couple of shakes of bitters into a little snort of water is a help for digestion. So when I have clients that don't have any money and they're not going to be able to buy things that they have to take on a daily basis, just take a tablespoon of water, put 2-3 shakes of bitters in there and slug that down about 15 minutes before you're ready to eat your meal. That can make a difference in improving digestion, just like the apple cider vinegar taken before a meal can improve the protein hydrochloric acid phase of digestion. So these betaine hydrochloride pills that will have these other ingredients in them, like gentian, are things you take after a meal. You'd never want to take them before a meal because you want the body to make all the acid that it's going to make before you add to it. But you see, if you had plenty of stomach acid and you took betaine hydrochloride, you'd actually get heartburn, which would tell you that you've got plenty of stomach acid and that isn't your problem. Maybe your problem is that you've got a food sensitivity. And I would tell you that fully 50% of people that I work with that have GERD, that have reflux, that have heartburn, that have sour risings, that are burping and tasting the food when they burp, virtually 50% of them are dairy sensitive. We take the dairy products out of their diet, their heartburn goes away. Now, that's not everybody. That's 50%. That's a lot, but it's not everybody. It may not be you, but it's worth an experiment. Because if you're starting every morning with half and half in your coffee and milk on your cereal, or cream cheese on your bagel, then you're starting your day setting that whole thing in motion. When we start using pancreatic enzymes before the meal and hydrochloric acid support with betaine hydrochloride after the meal, a lot of times we don't have to go any further. That takes care of it. It even takes care of your cracked fingernails. It even takes care of your burping. It even takes care of your itchy bottom. It takes care of a whole lot of things that are related to this hypoacidity. So it's not hyperacidity. It's not too much. It's hypoacidity. Hyperchlorhydria is the common term. You know, even coughing in your sleep, even chronic irritation in your throat, waking up in the morning hoarse. We know now that these stomach acids can actually go up into the nose and create problems of sinusitis. So when we look at the nature of the complaints that somebody can have as a result of hyper and hypochlorhydria, the list goes on. But a lot of it is just the hazardous American way of life. Like the comic said, it's the food. So if we want healthy digestion, one of the things that we have to do is take a breath. Stop. Before you're going to sit down and eat your food. I know you're not going to eat every meal in a relaxed environment. I know you got to get out the door to get to work, to get to your appointment, to pick up the kids, whatever it is. But at the same time, when you can just stop, take a breath, and prepare to be nourished. We eat to be nourished. We don't eat to be entertained. But you wouldn't know that from an awful lot of people. When you talk to them about food, it's, what's new? What's new? Have you been to the new restaurant? Have you tried the new? We're always interested in the evolution of food. In fact, I have people in my practice that spend more time watching the Food Channel than they do preparing their food. And they say there's no irony left in the world. When we begin to treat our meal times as a very special time for self-care. Because every plate of food you eat is a letter to your DNA. Every plate of food you eat is sending a message to your cells to tell them how to behave, to tell them to upregulate or downregulate, to tell them to make more of certain things or not make more of certain things. So when you look at that plate of food, is it really food? Or are you making it through the day with plastic fantastic? Are you making it through the day with delicious edibles that aren't really food? You know, about a fourth of that plate needs to be protein. About a fourth of that plate needs to be starch. One day it might be vegetable starch. Another meal it might be grain starch. And half of that plate needs to be non-starchy vegetables. You can't eat too many vegetables. Period. The nature of getting those veggies in is preeminent. If we're going to correct this digestion, ultimately, there has to be a lifestyle change. You can't just trade a drug for an over-the-counter product and an over-the-counter product for a natural remedy and continue to eat the same slop you've been eating that caused the problem in the first place. So, yeah, you can do all of the other things. You can make sure that you raise the head of your bed 6 inches, you know, go to the store and buy those 6 by 6 inch blocks and put them underneath your headboard so that your bed is slanted so the acid can't travel up the esophagus. Yeah, that's a good idea. But it doesn't solve the problem. It solves the symptom. When we look at natural remedies, I use a product in my practice. It's an old herbal formula. It's a formula that came from 1895, and it'll get rid of that burning in a heartbeat. Clients will turn to me and go, wow, this can't work this fast, can it? And in fact, it does work that fast, but it still doesn't solve the problem. If we don't deal with the underlying issue, which is the food selection in the first place, we're not going to be able to solve the problem. Heartburn is not just grandma's cooking. Heartburn is not just the pepperoni pizza and the chocolate malt. Heartburn is a very serious thing. Because if we constantly get that splashback of acid into the esophagus, into the throat, even into the sinuses, we're going to create still another problem. But just turning off the faucet on those parietal cells is not going to solve the problem. And that's especially true for people that have been on these proton pump inhibitors for a long period of time. I can't take somebody off a drug that a doctor has prescribed. That's a limit of my license. But I can make people aware of the problems that can happen when they stay on them. Some people have been diagnosed with something called Barrett's esophagitis. Barrett's esophagitis, they are told that they have to be on these proton pump inhibitors forever and ever, amen. Barrett's esophagitis does have the potential to turn into a cancer. It's a very low potential, but it's a real potential. But the nature of even Barrett's esophagitis means that we have to change our choices. We have to change the lifestyle choices. I had a client in my practice recently that was drinking 10 cups of coffee a day. 10 cups of coffee a day is pretty hard on a stomach lining. That lifestyle change has to be made. And happily, he was willing to make it. So I don't know what choices you're making that aren't working for your stomach. All I know is that using proton pump inhibitors is going to put you at risk of heart attack, put you at risk of osteoporosis, and put you at risk of a B12 deficiency. None of that is good news. And so if we want to really have wellness, wellness isn't just an absence of disease. Wellness is not just an absence of pain. Wellness is a positive vitality. It's a continuum. At one end you have health, at the other end you have death. Somewhere to the right of optimal health, you have a sign or a symptom that may turn into a disease. It might start with experiencing discomfort after eating. And so maybe your doctor told you to chew your food more thoroughly. Start there. In a wellness scenario, the time to tackle the problem is when you have the first small signs. Remember, indigestion is not caused by a Rolaids deficiency. Indigestion is caused because you chose something your body says, "Oh, honey, I don't think that's a good idea." A lot of us make these short-lived attempts toward wellness. We begin a new diet every Monday. We make New Year's resolutions that we've forgotten by Valentine's Day. But if we really want to express wellness, then we're going to be in a situation where we have to look at all of the choices that we make around food, starting with just taking a deep breath before you eat, getting more veggies into you, taking some digestive enzymes, and realizing that proton pump inhibitors have a dark side. I'm Eve Prang-Plues. I'm a licensed nutrition counselor and certified practitioner from the Institute for Functional Medicine. I've been in practice here in Sarasota for 27 years. This